With medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
Diabetes affects nearly 1 in 10 American adults. We'll talk to a Mayo Clinic researcher who says there's a fine line between enough treatment and too much in the effort to control blood sugar. Her study indicates younger, healthier patients may benefit from more intense treatment. Then, the American Heart Association recently released a scientific statement stressing the importance of the connection between mind, heart, and body. We'll learn about the most dangerous negative psychological health conditions from the lead author of the statement. And could a computer match or even outperform a human physician in diagnosing illnesses? A researcher from the Harvard Medical School has the answer. That's all straight ahead on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Diabetes affects nearly 1 in 10 adults in the U.S. 90% of those have type 2 diabetes. Some can use diet or exercise to keep the problem in check, but most often, patients need medications or insulin to control their type 2 diabetes. Like any ailment, it's crucial that doctors manage patients' treatment correctly. But now, a Mayo Clinic study shows the management for some may be what Mayo calls dangerously misaligned. Joining us now to discuss the findings is Dr. Rosalina McCoy, an endocrinologist, primary care physician, and the study's lead author. Dr. McCoy, your study's major findings concern two separate segments of the population. So let's start by focusing on the segment that's older or has serious health conditions. Now, for this particular group only, what did your study find?
People with diabetes who are older or who have extensive comorbidities really need to balance their diabetes management with everything else that goes on in their lives, including their other health needs. So for those individuals, we really want to be careful to make sure that they're treated with the right type and the right number of glucose-lowering medications. We don't want to lower their blood sugars too much because that can increase the risk of them having hypoglycemia or a dangerously low blood sugar, which is dangerous both kind of right now in this moment and going forward. So we want to make sure that we don't use too many medications, we don't lower blood sugar too much, and that we're mindful to keep kind of revisiting diabetes management and adjusting it going forward. And yet what we found is that on the population level, older people and people with extensive comorbidities are very frequently treated intensively. They are treated to low hemoglobin A1C or low blood sugar targets, and they're treated with medications that increase their risk of having hypoglycemia. These are medications like insulin or sulfonylurea drugs.
Now, why is hypoglycemia, this blood sugar that falls dangerously low, more of a potential danger than a slightly elevated blood sugar level for this particular segment of the population that is older and with these more serious chronic health conditions?
Very low blood sugar levels are dangerous. They are dangerous because glucose or sugar is the only nutrient that can be used for energy by the brain. So the absence of glucose affects brain function. It can also lead to arrhythmias or cardiovascular events and mortality. So when somebody's blood sugar drops dangerously low, patients can be in a coma, can have a seizure, can pass out, or can have a cardiac event. So it's very dangerous in this moment as it's happening. More mild low blood sugar episodes are also dangerous in the long term because they too can increase the risk of having heart disease or even developing dementia down the road. When we think about high blood sugars, it's actually very similar because mild elevations in high blood sugar levels cause problems down the road. They increase the risk of heart disease, of stroke, of kidney disease, of eye disease, of nerve damage, but they do so many years down the road. Very high blood sugar levels, just like very low blood sugar levels, are dangerous in the here and now because they too can cause people to have what's called ketoacidosis or hyperglycemic hyperosmolar state, where really high blood sugars cause people to go into a coma or become dangerously ill. So when we think about blood sugars, very low and very high are both dangerous right here and now. It's just that people historically have focused and recognized the dangers of very high blood sugar levels. And I'm talking, you know, blood sugars in the several hundreds up to 1,000 milligrams per deciliter. But there's been less attention about low blood sugar, and that's what we've been focusing on as well.
Now, a lot of people hear about the A1C level. Either they have a problem with diabetes or they see it on TV commercials. Is there a guideline or target A1C level for this particular segment of the population, that is, people who are older and those who have those chronic serious health matters?
Absolutely. So hemoglobin A1C levels need to be individualized to the clinical and just life context of each individual patient. So for people who are older and who have multiple comorbidities, the hemoglobin A1C target is higher than for people who don't have those comorbidities. Now, I want to note that age alone is not a reason to not treat, you know, diabetes or to target a high hemoglobin A1C level. It's really older age and so either advanced age that signifies limited life expectancy or older adults who have multiple comorbidities. So the American Diabetes Association guidelines recommend that for people who have really life-limiting advanced comorbidities like dementia or end-stage kidney disease or metastatic cancer, that we kind of tolerate hemoglobin A1C levels up to 8 or even 8.5%. Values above that correspond to blood sugar levels at which people have kind of acute symptoms. So we want to make sure people don't experience those. But that compares to otherwise healthy individuals for whom hemoglobin A1C targets are less than 7%. So you can see that there is really a continuum of acceptable hemoglobin A1C levels that depend on both the individual's comorbidity burden and also the medications that are used to achieve it, because we can't equate someone who has a hemoglobin A1C of 8% while treated with intensive insulin therapy. Increasing treatment more would cause potential harm, such as hypoglycemia, to people who have that hemoglobin A1C with no medications alone. So that's why it's so important to think about not only the hemoglobin A1C, but also the medications that are used to achieve it.
So, doctor, let's now focus on the second group. These are people younger and healthier. What did the study reveal about them?
Yeah, so we found the exact opposite of what we saw for the older patients and patients with comorbidities, and also the opposite of what we were hoping to find. So young and healthy individuals very often achieve or were treated to high hemoglobin A1C levels. And they were less likely than patients who were older or had comorbidities to be treated with intensive insulin therapy or even any insulin therapy. So while older and more clinically complex patients were treated intensively and to low hemoglobin A1C levels, lower than recommended by the guidelines, young and healthy patients were treated to high hemoglobin A1C levels and were not treated with intensive therapy, again, completely against the clinical practice guidelines.
So it seems like the opposite of the desired results were being achieved.
Exactly. It seems that, you know, while we as a community have been focusing on getting appropriate diabetes care to our patients and preventing overtreatment and preventing undertreatment, what we're seeing, what is really happening, is the opposite of what we want. The people who are most likely to benefit from intensive insulin therapy are not getting it. And yet people who do not derive meaningful benefit from intensive control and who can be harmed by that level of control, they still are treated intensively. So it's unfortunate to see that our care is being delivered, but care is not being delivered to the right patient in the right way at the right time.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, we'll ask Dr. McCoy more about whether treatments could be eased or relaxed for some patients. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Rosalina McCoy, an endocrinologist, primary care physician, and the lead author of a Mayo Clinic study. It suggests that patients with type 2 diabetes often receive treatment that's either too aggressive or not aggressive enough. Doctor, you studied 194,000 patients with type 2 diabetes, looking at the A1C levels and the use of insulin or a medication that simulates insulin production across different age groups. I note that you looked specifically at whether patients had one or more of 16 particular serious diseases or chronic conditions. Why were those 16 important?
Yeah, we reviewed kind of the currently available clinical practice guidelines for the management of diabetes to see whether there are particular comorbidities that really warrant reassessment of diabetes therapy. So situations where the comorbidity burden is kind of so either significant or so impactful on the patient that physicians should think differently about how we care for patients and really pursue less intensive treatment goals and treatment approaches to care. So reviewing specifically the American Diabetes Association guidelines and the guidelines released by Veterans Affairs Administration, they kind of provided a framework for thinking about both diabetes related comorbidities and just general health conditions that signify complex health status for our patients. And those were the conditions that we focused on in our study.
Now, you did draw a comparison between how people with diabetes and a serious additional condition, which you're saying comorbidity, were treated as opposed to people in the same age group without additional serious disease. How did those numbers actually come out?
When we looked at the increasing number of comorbidities in patients, and we looked at for each hemoglobin A1C level that these patients achieved, how likely they were to be treated with either sulfonylurea or with insulin in order to achieve those levels. What we wanted to see was that as the number of serious comorbidities increased, the percent of patients who are treated intensively would decrease. And yet we found the opposite, that again, no matter how we looked at the burden of comorbidities, whether these were related to diabetes, whether they were not related to diabetes, or whether they were really advanced life-threatening comorbidities like cancer and end-stage kidney disease, the more comorbidities someone had, the more frequently they were treated intensively.
And for patients with serious conditions, your study found an average A1C of 7%. Now, considering that the A1C targets that we were discussing earlier for older people with serious conditions, between 7.5 to 8.5, which are more relaxed, does your finding indicate that treatments should be relaxed or eased for this population?
Absolutely. I think, you know, what was so concerning in our study is that for patients who have advanced comorbidity burden or multiple comorbidities, not only did they achieve low hemoglobin A1C levels, so lower than recommended by the guidelines, but they did so using high-risk medications like sulfonylureas and insulin. And what that tells us is that we as physicians can scale back on our therapy and treat patients less aggressively. And while that would potentially see a rise in their hemoglobin A1C, because they're so intensively treated right now, any rise through de-escalation would still be in a safe range. So we're not going to harm patients if we scale back on therapy, but I believe that doing so would significantly lower their risk of experiencing low blood sugar, which again can be fatal or very harmful in that population.
Our guest today is Dr. Rosalina McCoy, an endocrinologist, primary care physician, and lead author of a Mayo Clinic study raising concerns on how doctors manage their patients' type 2 diabetes. Now let's go to the flip side. The study found the highest A1C levels at an average of 7.7% were among people ages 18 to 44. Now, isn't that number, 7.7%, a fair amount higher than the recommended target of 7% for most people? In other words, characterize how big a swing that is.
Yeah, I think it's a big difference. And you know, when we think about young and healthy people, and you know, with type 2 diabetes, we really should be targeting hemoglobin A1C levels, you know, somewhere between 6.5% and 7%, so much lower than the 7.7% that you mentioned. And this increase, even though it seems to be very small, when we think about the time horizon for these individuals in their, you know, many years left in life, that translates to significantly higher risk of these long-term complications of having premature heart disease, stroke, you know, kidney disease, including need for dialysis, neuropathy and amputation. So even these relatively small increases in A1C in 10, 20 years down the road will significantly impair these individual lives.
Now, you mentioned before that doctors often fail to recognize when it's time to adjust a patient's treatment. Do you believe doctors are just not aggressive enough in asking the right questions or drawing out the patient for clues that would impact medical decisions?
You know, I think really the question about why is treatment not changed, and this applies both to intensifying therapy for patients who need intensification and de-intensifying therapy for patients who need to have their treatment de-intensified is really complicated, because it's not only about, you know, me as a physician telling my patient, oh, we need to add another drug. Managing diabetes is hard. A lot of the medications that are used to treat diabetes are very expensive, and they may not be affordable to our patients, and especially young patients who may have high deductible health plans, you know, multiple jobs, and other things they need to balance. So lack of affordability of medications, inadequate access to seeing physicians, seeing diabetes educators or pharmacists, those are, you know, real big barriers to care. And I think often we may hope that continued work on lifestyle therapy or adherence to a current regimen kind of will do the trick and will push our patients towards better control. But unfortunately, that's often not enough. And we do need to think about what else can we do to help our patients, whether that means adding another medication and making sure that it's affordable and accessible to our patients, or making referrals to education or to pharmacy support, which too is often limited.
And on that very point, I was going to say that drug companies have come out with medications that lower glucose, but are less likely to cause hypoglycemia. Does your study suggest that perhaps not enough doctors know about these, or they're not being used enough? Do we know?
Yeah, so this particular study did not examine the use of the newer medications that not only are very effective at lowering hemoglobin A1C levels, but they have additional benefits for reducing the risks of heart disease, heart failure, or kidney disease. We recently published a different study that looked at the use of these medications, particularly among kind of older adults. And we found kind of a very similar and striking paradox, where patients who would benefit the most from these medications, so patients with heart disease, with kidney disease, they are less likely to be prescribed and use those medications compared to patients who don't have those comorbidities. And the biggest finding, I think, of that study was kind of hinted at the reason why, because the biggest differences were in patients who were lower income and in patients who had Medicare Advantage health plans compared to private insurance, so they weren't eligible for pharmacy benefit cards. And what that tells me is that one of the biggest barriers to using these new medications is their cost, that patients just can't afford the medications they need to live well with their diabetes.
Well, more to come, I'm sure, from you. Dr. Rosalina McCoy with the Mayo Clinic, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your studies.
Thank you so much.
Up next, the American Heart Association recently summarized the latest research into the mind-heart-body connection, and it involves more than just stress. We'll get advice from an expert with the Baylor College of Medicine in a moment here on MedClinic Radio.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. Water and food contaminated with feces. That's how the hepatitis A virus spreads, causing infection and inflammation of the liver.
It tends to be something that somebody eats or puts into their mouth with their hands and then develops symptoms. It is a self-limited infection, meaning you get very sick, but you eventually clear the infection without treatment, because unfortunately there is not treatment for hepatitis A.
Dr. Stacy Rizza says symptoms include nausea, vomiting, stomach aches, diarrhea, and jaundice. Certain groups of people have a higher risk.
In people who live in homeless facilities, hygiene is not always good. So it's easy to transmit the infection amongst a group who may be in close contact.
You can cut your risk of getting hepatitis A with good hand hygiene, hand washing, and the hepatitis A vaccination. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to Med Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
How much of an influence does your mental health have on your physical health? We're joined by Dr. Glenn Levine. He is a master clinician and professor of medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, plus the chief of the cardiology section at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, both in Houston. He also chairs the writing committee that recently issued a scientific statement from the American Heart Association. Dr. Levine, before we get into the statement, can you give us a look at how serious is the problem of heart disease in the United States today?
Heart disease, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is the number one cause of disease in the United States, and it's the number one cause of death in America. So it couldn't be any more serious than that.
This American Heart Association scientific statement is entitled Psychological Health, Well-Being, and the Mind-Heart-Body Connection. What research or information is contained in it that the average person should be aware of?
Well, the scientific statement really summarizes all of the studies over the last 20 or 30 years with an increasing number of recent studies and recognition that people's psychological health can clearly impact their risk of developing heart disease. And if they already have heart disease, can impact the chances of them having future problems with their heart or even dying from heart disease.
And can you describe these negative psychological factors? Do they just involve a pessimistic attitude toward life, or is it more than that?
Yes. So when we talk about psychological health, we can talk about negative psychological health or positive psychological health. And negative psychological health includes things like depression, pessimism, anxiety, and stress. And positive psychological health includes things like positive outlook, optimism, happiness, satisfaction with life, and then something called mindfulness, or your awareness of your surroundings and how your mind is doing.
What are some specific examples of physical illnesses caused by negative psychological factors?
What we see is that negative psychological factors such as depression, stress, and anxiety are certainly associated with an increased risk of having things like high blood pressure, of smoking, of being overweight, of not exercising, and even of actually developing heart disease, meaning blockages in your heart arteries, or having a heart attack, or even dying of heart disease. In contrast, positive psychological health, again, things like happiness, optimism, satisfaction in life, are associated with a lower risk of things like smoking, developing high blood pressure, or other risk factors for heart disease. And in patients who already have heart disease, if you have something like a positive outlook on life, it has been shown that you are less likely to die of heart disease down the road.
Among the negative factors your statement mentions are daily stressors and exposure to traumatic events. How do these two differ in terms of the physical effects?
Yeah, I think a better way to characterize it is acute stressors, things, one-time events that happen, and chronic stress. And there are a couple good examples of acute events. One of them is something that goes by the fancy name of stress cardiomyopathy, that if someone has extreme stress or sadness, frequently seen after a spouse dies, they actually develop what for all the world looks like a heart attack, including the classic chest pain people get, the changes we see on those 12-lead EKGs that we do. And then even when we look at the heart function using ultrasound or other techniques, we actually see the heart not pumping as well as it normally would, all because of that single stressful event. And there's another good example of this. In February of 1994, in Los Angeles, over a one-day period, the number of deaths due to heart disease more than doubled. It actually went up about 2.5 times. And what was found is the cause of this was a major earthquake in Los Angeles. So the stresses of that earthquake actually increased the number of deaths due to heart disease, probably mostly heart attack, 2.5 times. Now, in contrast, chronic stress is what we look at when we think of increased risk of smoking, high blood pressure, and developing heart disease. So that's, I think, the best distinction between a single acute stressful event and the more chronic negative psychological health, such as chronic stress, chronic anxiety, chronic depression.
Following that train of thought, I'll ask you to speculate just a bit here. What do you think the effects of COVID-19 and the lockdowns will have on heart health and heart deaths down the road?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think there is any doubt whatsoever that negative psychological health, things like stress, anxiety, depression, are going to go up significantly over the last year. You just have to turn on the news and see how many people have lost their jobs, how many people are under financial and economic stress, how many people feel socially isolated. So no doubt that all these factors are going to go up. And it is very reasonable to assume, along with them going up, the risk of developing heart disease is going to go up as well with that.
Our guest on MedClinic Radio is Dr. Glenn Levine from Baylor College of Medicine and the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, both in Houston. He also chairs the writing committee that recently issued a scientific statement from the American Heart Association. It focuses on the mind-heart-body connection. Dr. Levine, your paper summarizes ways to help improve psychological health for people with and at risk for heart disease. What top strategies do you recommend?
First and foremost, people with severe psychological illnesses, including severe depression, psychoses, bipolar disease, those people need very professional help with psychiatrists and will often require medication. For people with more chronic, not as severe disease, chronic stress, chronic low-grade depression, chronic anxiety, certainly psychologists and psychiatrists can offer help. And there are also what are called these mind-body interventions, programs that teach people to focus less on the negative, focus more on the positive, focus on being more mindful in the present and understanding how their mind works. And these are often 4 or 8 or 12 week programs. You may have heard things called such as behavioral therapy or mindfulness-based stress reduction. There are many types of these programs, and there are many other mind-body interventions, which there is at least some data that these not only improve one's psychological outlook, but actually can impact the risk of heart disease or dying from heart disease down the road.
Do you think people with chronic stress or maybe just a generally negative outlook typically recognize they have these conditions, or can a doctor identify them in a short office visit?
I think many people are aware of those things in general, but when you speak to a mental health professional or you participate in one of these programs, I think you are better able to recognize what is actually going on in your mind, why you tend to do the things that you do, to recognize that some reactions and some thought patterns are not productive and probably exacerbate things, and generally have a better understanding, at least, of how you are relating to what is going on in your life and possible ways to relate at least better to them.
Do you have any final words of advice for listeners? Maybe a takeaway message from the scientific statement?
Yeah, I think your listeners need to be aware that things like depression, anxiety, and stress are incredibly common in the United States. So you are not alone. This is a problem affecting many, many people, including many of your family members, many of your neighbors. So you're not alone, and that there are mental health professionals and a lot of different treatments, both drug-based and mind-body or counseling-based, that are very, very effective in helping decrease your stress, depression, anxiety, and help lead to a more positive attitude and really a more fulfilling life.
Glenn Levine, MD from Baylor College of Medicine and the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, both in Houston. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure.
Next, could a computer match or even outperform your doctor in diagnosing illnesses? We'll find out when MedClinic Radio continues.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Medical errors rank behind heart disease and cancer as the third leading cause of death in the U.S. Experts say more than 250,000 Americans die each year from mistakes by healthcare providers. So would taking the human equation out of diagnoses and letting computers diagnose illnesses save some lives? We're joined now by Ativ Mehrotra, MD, an associate professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. He led a study that examined how human physicians stack up against virtual ones. Dr. Mehrotra, welcome to MedClinic Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So, did you get a very clear result in your study on which is more effective, the human doctor or the digital one?
Yes, I think for all my physician colleagues out there, reassuring news that it appears that physicians are much better than at least one type of computers that we tested in terms of making an accurate diagnosis.
What is the typical error rate for a human doctor in recognizing common diseases?
Some recent work has really highlighted that it's more common than we'd like. The estimates are around 10 to 15% of the time when a patient sees a physician, there's a misdiagnosis.
How well do humans do in diagnosing less common diseases? Should we assume the error rate would be higher there?
You know, these are tough studies to figure out, so I don't know if we really know that answer, but I think it's a reasonable thought that for more complicated diseases, the error rate's higher.
And in comparison, would the error rate for computers be even higher than that?
Exactly. While we didn't look in this study at using real patients, we took vignettes or cases, and we gave them both to the computers and the physician. And in terms of getting the correct diagnosis, it was much higher among the physicians.
And like the humans, would the virtual doctors have an even greater difficulty with less common diseases?
Yeah, we saw that there. We divided up the cases or vignettes into different groups, those from how severe they were in terms of how quickly you needed care, from low severity things such as conjunctivitis and serious conditions like a heart attack. And similarly, how common the condition was. Was it something pretty rare, or was it something bread and butter that physicians see a lot? And in terms of the level of severity of the illness, the computers did much relatively better among the lower acuity things as opposed to the more severe or complex conditions.
There are some areas of medicine, though, aren't there, where computers and digital apps are really effective and do save lives, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one important aspect of this is that this is just one study here, and computers and computer science is advancing very, very rapidly. And so we might have a very different answer if we were to repeat the study in a couple years or 5-10 years down the line in terms of being able to do that really complex pattern recognition that physicians are doing right now when they see a patient. Maybe we will have computers soon that can do that.
the traditional office visit where a doctor examines you hands-on. Obviously, that's not something a computer could ever do, right?
No, that's true. And I think that the physical exam part is something that is going to be difficult for the computer to do, though certainly somebody else could do the physical exam and give those results to the computer. And we also, one of the kind of mantras in medicine is that most of the diagnoses are made based on the history of what the patient tells you, and relatively fewer cases is done by the exam and testing.
Our guest on MedClinic Radio is Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School, and he's the author of a study that examined how human physicians stack up against virtual ones. Dr. Mehrotra, what are doctors' attitudes about this concept of virtual doctors? Are they threatened by it, or do they see it as a potentially useful tool?
I think this has been so theoretical till now that I don't know if anyone's been particularly concerned. I think there are many who feel that it'll never happen, that computers can replace what they're doing. So I don't know if there's a clear consensus among the physician community.
As many people are self-diagnosing on Google and elsewhere online, do you take that to mean that patients are somewhat open to this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the computer programs that we evaluated are called symptom checkers, which is these websites or apps that people can use to try to figure out what might be going on with them. These are things like WebMD, iTriage, Isabel, and a bunch of others that we looked at. And they are very popular. We estimated more than 100 million uses per year by people of these websites or self-diagnosis tools. Obviously, our results highlight that they have a high rate of inaccuracy, but I also think it's important to recognize why the public are going to use these tools. Because first, it's that basic question that so many people struggle with on a day-to-day basis, which is, I'm feeling ill. Is this something is worth going to the doctor or not? Or should I just stay at home and have chicken soup? And so this can help people figure that out. And in particular, in a circumstance where we're having more and more of the American public have high deductible health plans, this can be a big deal. Going to the doctor could be $150, $200 per visit. People are pausing before they go to the physician.
Do you see this as a potential cost saver, or might it add to the cost of our national healthcare system?
I don't know if we know the answer to that. It matters how people interpret this information. If they're going to these symptom checkers and choosing, therefore, not to go into the physician's office, it might decrease healthcare spending and decrease how much people have to pay out of pocket. But if it scares them and causes, some people have called it cyberchondria, where they look things up online and get more scared, then it actually could increase costs because people are going to the doctor more than they were before. We just don't know the answer of how these tools are being used.
So taking this to its greatest extreme in the future, how do you envision it? Would someone physically go to a doctor's office and be examined by a human, and then information from that is entered into the digital diagnostic tool? Or is it possible that this could become the ultimate telemedicine and be done entirely patient to computer?
You know, one of the criticisms of this work is that we did this, you could call it almost a false comparison, doctors versus computers. But, you know, in reality, as we think about how computers are being incorporated into our lives, you could see a future where computers are augmenting physicians. And what I mean by that is you go see the physician types in the electronic health record, what might be going on with you in terms of your symptoms. And on the side there, a support tool comes up and says, well, here are some diagnoses that could be going on. And it's now the combination of the doctor and computer that gets to the diagnosis as opposed to just the doctor alone. Now, right now, I'll be clear, that is a theoretical idea or something far in the future, but I could see how that in the future is something quite attractive, and if it's done well, then could be very useful for patients.
In this rapidly changing technological world, far in the future, quote-unquote, could be what, 5 years down the road?
I know. Sometimes you think something far in the future is next month, so it's hard to know exactly. I mean, I think right now there might be a lot of skepticism among the people who work in the medical world right now because our electronic health records are quite painful, but maybe in the future this is something that could be a very helpful tool.
Fascinating topic. Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for your interest.
And that's MedClinic Radio for this week. MedClinic Radio is a production of Syndication Networks. If you would like to listen to past shows, check out our website, medclinicradio.com. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of MedClinic Radio. Syndication.